communicating with animals. If you've had a pet, you know that relationship. In a moment, Rosalind Byrne joins us. We'll talk more about this as we explore this incredible communication between animals and people next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Rosalind Byrne, PhD, explores the interacting realms between emerging technology, science fiction, mythology, and between humans and non-human worlds. As a university professor, she writes and teaches about engineering and technology in society and the ethical implications of this development, often using science fiction material in her class. Now, in her personal life, she continues to discover the nature of human-equine relationships and offers the translation services between horses and animals. She was on with me about 4 years ago. She's written a number of books, including Nanotalk, When the Horses Whisper, and Waking to Beauty. And I believe, is Waking to Beauty your last book, Rosalind?
It's the most recent one, George, but I hope it's not the last.
I hope not either. You're pretty prolific. I don't think you'll stop, will you?
I don't think so, but you have to be in the flow, so it comes and goes.
Tell me the difference between what you've done professionally and what I would say is this other end of your life, and that's this communication between animals and you.
Professionally, I teach in an engineering school. I am trained not as an engineer, but as a bioethicist. So what I teach is to help students think about the ethical and social implications of engineering design and practice.
Now, by that, it would cover what? Things like don't create machines that wipe out everybody's careers?
Yeah, you know, that's sort of the subtext, but I try to be more subtle than that because I'll lose them. So what I try to do is, like, go with them to look at the things they're excited about, and then we just take another deeper or look at it from the other side. So some of them are working with really, really, really small devices, which is nanoscience. Some of them are working with computer science, and now, you know, you can computerize new genes to make new organisms. So, or something as basic as working with water with my civil engineer. So at all those points, we say, okay, so what does this really mean for how people experience life and for the planet itself?
Is it difficult to teach ethics to somebody?
It is if you preach, and it is if you tell them that you're going to tell them what's right. I start by telling them, I don't know what's right. Let's explore that together.
Because they have to have it from within, don't they?
It doesn't work any other way.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Now, you have had an incredible upbringing yourself. I mean, you're involved in the engineering school. You deal with horses. You dealt with ghosts as a child. You had an OBE, out-of-body experience. You're a different kind of person.
You read my books.
Yes, we do.
That's great. People have said that, and I've learned to live with that. Yeah.
Has it changed you or affected you?
Who I am?
Mm-hmm.
You know that expression, fish don't know they're wet? It's just like who I am. It's sort of like learning how to navigate in the world and then recognizing people don't always quite understand who I am, and trying to sort of fit in changed me. The horses have changed me. Seeing ghosts is what I did when I was, 2 years old, and that was just what I knew.
Yeah, exactly. Next hour, I want to expand our conversation, Rosalind, when we take phone calls with people who have owned animals, pets, and see what they say about this communication gap or tie-in. I'm convinced that people, once they really understand and get close to the animal, to the I'll call it the pet for lack of a better phrase, they really have this connection. It's there, isn't it?
I agree with you. Absolutely.
Let me ask you how you got involved with horses, first of all.
Well, the first pass was when I was about 11 years old, and I went to summer camp, but I was a city kid.
Uh-huh.
So I had to come home to the city after camp, but I came home sad because I'd fallen in love with a horse named Aladdin, an Arabian horse, gelding named Aladdin. But there's nothing my parents could do to help me with that, to go back to my regular life, but I fantasized a lot about being with horses. Fast forward about, I don't want to tell you how many years, but to about 7 years ago, and I was in Costa Rica riding a horse after a long intense riding retreat. I took a break, got on a horse, went on a trail ride, fell off the horse into a river.
Ooh.
And when I got back, it was actually, I didn't get hurt at all.
Okay, you're good, good.
I got back up, and something had changed. I hopped on that horse wet from head to toe, and I heard that horse talking, and it was quite a conversation we had.
You heard it talking, telepathy-wise?
I think that's the best way to describe it, but it was full sentences. He said, I can't believe you fell off. No one's ever fallen off before. How did that happen? Am I going to be in trouble? Are you okay? That kind of thing. And then I realized something had opened. In that fall, it's like I went from deaf to audible, to being able to hear at that level. And I said, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. And then he asked me to do him a favor. He said, you can really understand me. I said, yeah, I can. He asked me to help him by telling his owner something that was bothering him. And when I did, she was shocked because she said I had no way of knowing the situation that he described.
What was it that the horse was bothered by?
What he said is, tell Debbie I don't need any more training. All I need is a break from these trail rides now and then. I don't need any more training.
Bored to death, wasn't it?
Well, what happened was, you know, he was taking, you know, scores of people out weekly on his back, and he was just needed a break.
Yeah.
But they thought he was misbehaving, so they were going to send him back for training. And so what she told me was, you can't have known that last week the stableman and I were discussing this, sending him in particular out of all their horses for more training. Those were her precise words, and those were his precise words. And now she told me, she's actually visiting with me now from Costa Rica, she told me that they used to do a program for a week and then put them back in training. Now they put them out to pasture so they can play and frolic and rest and restore.
You may be too young to remember a television program called Mr. Ed about a horse that talked.
Wilbur.
That's right. You probably saw them in syndication.
You are dating
me,
you kind man.
Yeah, that's right. You saw them in syndication. See, I watched them when they were live.
Loved them. Couldn't wait to see them. That and Bewitched, but that's another story.
Do you remember the theme song?
A horse is a horse.
That's right. It was a great show. Great show, indeed. I think Wilbur, the guy who played Wilbur, finally just died.
I'm
pretty sure he did.
We had a great run there.
I'll check into that. You know, I once owned 72 horses myself.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and I've got to tell you, there is a connection there, especially through the eyes of the horse. Did you notice that?
Well, I feel like I'm lost in another world when I look in their eyes. I don't know what you mean by that, but wow.
They look at you.
Yes, they do.
They really look at you, and sometimes they look through you.
Mm.
It was just a. There is a bond there.
Mm. And because they can see so wide and far back, almost to their hindquarters, you might be standing off to the side and not realize they're really looking at you.
Did you deal primarily and only with horses or all kinds of animals?
Well, I'm primarily dealing with horses, but something odd is happening, and that I can sense other animals are seeing me differently now. So, like random dogs on a walk will wander over, and I'm feeling that some kind of channel is opening more directly with other animals as well. However, I now live on a horse farm, and the clients I have horses, and I write mostly about horses. I think that the kingdom itself of animals and plants is much more communicative than we've given them credit for.
You may be right. By the way, Wilbur did die. His real name was Alan Young, and he died last year.
Oh.
96 years old, right out here in Los Angeles.
Well, I hope he thrived after that show went off.
Well, you know what's kind of interesting? He lived until he was 96. I'm wondering if being around a horse that long makes you younger or does something to you.
You know, I'm all for it if it's going to make me younger. I feel great around my horses. They certainly do move energy, and they do support us energetically.
Yeah,
That's for sure.
they sure do. As a matter
Now,
of
what were
fact,
you doing with that many horses? I don't understand that. That's a lot of horses for one horse.
breeding them, racehorses.
Oh, you were in the racehorse?
Yeah,
Oh, yes. Talk
standardbreds.
about that.
Standardbred breed, you know, the ones with the person who sat behind the sulky,
Oh.
they ate a lot, though, all the time.
I have a
But I
horse
had
named
fun doing
Max.
that.
I'm sorry?
Had a 114-acre farm in Illinois,
Wow.
and it started as a hobby. You know, back when I was 22 years old, I bought my first racehorse with a group of six guys in Detroit. You know, we each put in a couple $1,000 and made some money on it, and then turned it into number two, number three, and got pretty good at it after a while. But it's a business that once the casinos started popping up in various states, the horse racing business really got hurt. And though it's still strong in some areas, it's not like it used to be at all. It's changed dramatically. But let's get into the story of Waking to Beauty. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, after I wrote When the Horses Whisper, people were asking me, well, where did this come from, this ability? And do other people have it? And I didn't have an answer to that question, so I just wanted to muse on it. And before I knew it, Waking to Beauty was coming alive. It started because I went back to Costa Rica to visit with a mare named Beauty, who I think is quite an evolved being. Like human beings, horses vary in their awareness and awakeness, and beauties are quite something extraordinary. And we had a profound experience with her, and I started writing about that, and then that led to reflecting on my own evolution and my own learning and growth and experiences through encountering these different kinds of beings, whether they are disembodied spirits, souls of people, or horses like Beauty and a stallion named Wano. So that's sort of what that was about, letting people know, well, here are what I think the roots of my own development and capacities and gifts, and here's some things that these other beings are saying that they want humans to understand.
This communicative relationship with horses, did you also have it with dogs or cats or other animals?
We had three cats for a while when I was a child, and one was mine. His name was Topaz. I was young, say 11, 10, and I was pretty sullen and sometimes a bit depressive as a child. And I don't know from my memory what happened, but I know he spent hours on my lap and something was going on there. I suspect we were communicating.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, with this newest book, Waking to Beauty, you highlight the conversations with a couple of horses. But they had something interesting to say about us, didn't they?
That's a word for it. Here, I was sitting in an arena in Costa Rica with Beauty, and she changed the conversation in such a way that I began to weep, literally to weep. And I was,
Really?
yes, and I was in shock. What happened was she started talking about, I can feel the emotion now, she started talking about the state of humanity and our relationship with nature beyond us and the planet. And she said something like, the earth cherishes the human, but in order for the earth to be able to maintain and keep whole and alive and balance all of what is living on the earth, the humans are now at a point where it may not keep them. And she said, we're really, really close to the edge of the earth shifting in such a way that it no longer sustains us. I just started weeping because I didn't expect that. I didn't imagine it would ever come from a horse, and I didn't believe it myself. So I wasn't sure. I didn't think it was coming from my subconscious.
Right.
And she was quite serious about it. And she said, we have just a little time left to figure out how to be here in a way that is not so destructive to the whole, but that Earth, very much in itself and all its creatures, want very, very, very much for us to be able to remain. But it's like the greatest good for the whole. We're too much of a threat to the greatest good for the whole.
How would a horse be able to sense that?
See, now that is a really good question. Beauty is an unusual horse. I mean, I live with three horses. They're not like Beauty. Beauty is like an unusual human being. Think of some really tuned-in human beings that have been on this planet occasionally who are really aware, and she's like that. So how? I don't know. Maybe energy, frequencies, vibrations of some sort? I don't know. Maybe she just can sense an out of alignment or a greater separation between us. I think there is something, a life force. I do believe there is a life force that's palpable and can be sensed, and that much of it emanates from the planet that sustains and supports us in relation to the sun that sort of makes it all possible through, you know, light and photosynthesis. So maybe she just feels all of that as being increasingly out of alignment, but this is the way I interpreted what she was saying.
Did you ever have any doubts that it was coming from the horse?
No, because of the way I was feeling in reaction. There was nowhere else for it to be coming from, unless the horse is being used by some other being. Now, I suppose that's possible, but it was us. It was just the two of us. Yeah. Wow. And then what happened, which is really amazing, she started talking about energy that is feminine and masculine. And she was explaining about how we are out of sorts in our human ability to feel and work with those energies, and that we've sort of lost our way with that. And then in walks the stallion, and he says, "You need to hear from me too." And he starts in, and he starts talking about how he experiences human males, who many of whom have disconnected with the flow of masculine energy. Now, that's a little creepy, because we do know that all the phytoestrogens that we're exposed to now are changing the levels of hormones that we have in our body, men and women. But I got the feeling he was talking about an energetic commitment to or feeling from these different forces, what they refer to as the feminine and masculine. That's how I interpreted them.
Do the horses, do the animals warn you about anything impending? Do they sense that?
Oh, well, my friend Debbie from Costa Rica, who owns this horse farm, was just telling me. She went out and sat on a log in a field recently, and three horses came straight up to her and started staring at her. And she was like, what? What are you doing? What are you bothering me for? What's going on? And she felt like they were saying, move now, move now. So she thought, okay. So she got up, and just then a hive of pretty aggressive bees came out of that log. And one horse started moving in such a way that the bees were attracted to it. So Debbie only got a few stings, and that horse was covered with bees. They could sense and feel that hive. She didn't sense it. They came to warn her. So that's just sort of an immediate, direct example of what you're saying. But some horses, I think, most horses are not sort of time-oriented, because they're so very immediately in the present moment. And part of what they teach us is how to do that, because we're not good at that, our species. But a few, like Beauty, unusual beings, I think are aware more generally of movement through dimensions and time, if that makes sense.
All right, when we come back in a moment, Rosalyn, I'll chat more with you about specifically this tie-in of communications. And then in our final hour, the hour that we take phone calls, of course, we will talk with everybody about their animal relations. I want to hear those stories, things that have happened, because they are real and they happen. Rosalyn's website, a couple of them, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about her latest work called Waking to Beauty. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rosalyn Byrne with us. Rosalyn, when you talk to the horses, the animals, and they give you advice and opinion, could they be wrong?
Okay. Well, many of the horses I talk to are talking about their own circumstances. Their own health, their own emotional or psychological circumstances, relationships with the people who are their caregivers or their owners. It's a very unusual horse that's talking about something more general like humanity. Could they be wrong? Well, sure. I mean, I'm wrong often, or not often, but sometimes.
Would they mislead you?
I don't think horses do because of the way they live in such the immediate present moment, and their senses or awarenesses are all very attuned to the immediate present moment. That's how they have evolved to survive. I think it's our cerebral cortex that allows us to be deceptive and manipulative. Horses can be playful, they can be jokesters, but I don't think they ever do it with the intention of causing harm the way humans can.
Did they ever show you temper?
Temper as in fury, anger.
I like that name, though, by the way. Fury for a horse.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Little play on words there.
Only if they've been threatened, but it doesn't feel like our anger. It more feels like self-protection. I've met horses that are sad, that are depressed.
Because of the way they're treated?
Yes, like mostly it's because what we find out is that they miss a former owner, or they don't understand what happened and why they've been moved or sold or displaced, and they had friends in other horses or in other people, and they're depressed because they're confused and they're at a loss for those former relationships because people don't tell their horses what's happening. They just sell them and then they just they're driven off and they're somewhere new. And so I've seen that kind of emotion. I haven't seen anger per se. I've seen more sort of sadness or protection. Like I have a adopted a horse from a rescue facility who would pull her ears back and like snap like she was going to bite me, and I didn't take that as anger. I took that as a horse that he was either had been abused or was mistrustful or and tried to protect herself. They're very protective of themselves.
Did you ever have a horse rear back on its hind legs at you?
Now, I have seen horses kick,
They do
mostly
kick.
each other for establishing territory and protecting themselves. One of the horses I adopted actually did kick the person who rescued her, and that was a little baffling, but that person takes responsibility as coming up on her too quickly. I want to say I'm sensing you've seen angry horses, or I know that they fight.
Well, they bite too.
Oh, absolutely. My horse will act like she's going to bite. Do you think that's anger?
It's twofold. It's trying to, as you mentioned, be very competitive and show, this is my turf. But there's also anger there. Maybe not as much,
What would they
but
be
it's
angry about?
who knows? I never talked to one. Maybe I should have.
Well, I hope.
However, let me ask you this, and then I want to talk about your NanoTalk book because that fascinates me too. When this happened to you, how do you know that you're not the special one, that you're not the one that's picking this up? I'm wondering if not a lot of people have this ability, but you do.
I occasionally wonder where this information is coming from, and if the horse is a conduit somehow for me to tune in more deeply. It's a really good question, and I wish I had an answer to it. In a way, I don't want to know. I don't want to feed my ego with some kind of thought of some kind of power or ability.
Right. I'm the one. I do
I
it.
don't want to have that. But I think that perhaps many of us do, and we haven't tapped into that part of ourselves. I'm just sort of an open student of life, George, trying to understand, but mostly just living what happens.
When this has happened to you, and now that it's ongoing, what has been the most compelling thing you think you've picked up from the animal?
Well, they're teaching me to be much more present and aware of my own self, especially of my body and how I'm feeling physically or emotionally, and less sort of driven by my brain part, the brain part that's processing and worrying and calculating and anticipating and planning. So now I feel much more balanced and whole because of them. You have to be very present to be in the presence of a horse, because anything can happen really quickly, as you know. And you have to be, your intention has to be very clear, and you have to be really grounded. Now, some people don't. They just break horses and push them around and brutalize them emotionally or physically and get what they want. But if you want to have a true, deep relationship, and I think this is true with dogs and cats and other pets, you have to really come at them with clarity and a heart-centered way of being. And I learned how to do that, not so much through humans, but through horses. And I feel so much more alive now.
Though other people, and we'll find out when we take calls next hour, may have this same kind of relationship with a dog or cat or maybe a hamster. Who knows?
People have them with pigs.
Yeah. Well, pigs are smart.
Very.
Very. They probably say, why do you use our parts in your body?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a whole conversation, isn't it?
Yeah,
I had an extraordinary experience with dolphins once, and I think I wrote about it in Waking the Beauty.
If dolphins had arms and thumbs and fingers, they would do things beyond what we can do.
Oh, my goodness gracious. We have a lot to learn from them.
All right, let me talk about NattoTalk for a second. I mean, as a professor of ethics, tell me about NattoTalk. What that was all about. You wrote that in 2005, didn't you?
I did. What I did was I found about 35 scientists and applied scientists who are engineers who are working at the nanoscale. Nano is about scale. It's about going down to really, 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 really small because properties of matter act differently at that scale. And they're trying to capture those properties so that they can apply them to new products and new processes. So, for example, sun reflects differently when with a molecule that's at the nanoscale like titanium dioxide. So now when you have sunscreen, you put it on and it's like a crystal clear, smooth product and you don't know you're covering your skin because it's working at the nanoscale, whereas in the old days with zinc oxide, you'd smear it on, you have like a white nose with all that pasty stuff. So engineers are always interested in making new products and making things work much better. And at the nanoscale, you can capture what nature does at that scale that it doesn't do at the macro scale. So they have all kinds of applications, even like working with gold nano to help with cancer treatment. So what I did was I went around the country talking to 35 different scientists who are working at this scale, and I went back to see them twice a year for 5 years to follow their work, but mostly to talk to them very personally. What's motivating this? What concerns you? What worries you? Where do you think you're going with this? What could happen if you were successful? And I was trying to parse out how they reflect about ethics and their social responsibility as scientists.
Interesting. Now, do you know what a chimera is?
Yes.
Okay.
I've written about one in my science fiction book.
All right. You talk about ethics.
Mm.
Don't you think science is going too far when they're starting to mend human parts with animal parts?
You know, too far. So I'm really concerned about all kinds of things we're doing, whether it's with creating chimera from manipulating genes or synthetic biology. Or
what about cloning?
We're doing all of these things. So human beings are curious. We are not going to stop pursuing knowledge, and that's a good thing because it allows us to live with more health and more awareness and more, you know. The problem is that intelligence is not always linked to ethics. It's not always linked to compassion and care. Sometimes it's linked to hubris and motives that are for more, like more profit without regard for what it means. That's what scares me. It's not the knowledge itself that scares me. We now have the knowledge to create new gene expressions and create organisms that don't even exist in nature through synthetic biology. Does that scare me? It scares me in part because we don't know enough about life to be able to create new life without potentially wreaking havoc on things. So I wish we would slow down, learn, but not apply so quickly. But we're very pressed to apply quickly because we want to recoup our expenses. We want to make good on our investments. We want to go into new markets and sell things. So, sure, let's rearrange some parts and create animals that don't exist that have different qualities. We can do this for good, like we can create drugs to help malaria. We can do this for play and experimentation to see what happens. I think it's dangerous if we don't carry in some very, very deep commitment to care and truly learning, not just benefiting from the new things we create.
Should we be playing around with Mother Nature? That's an ethical question, I think.
Should we? That's where the word, that's where ethics comes in. Ought, should. Personally, I think there are a lot of serious problems that we have, very serious, that can threaten the well-being of humanity, and that we need to be as vigilant as we can in learning and creating new treatments for things. However, I think that that's not all we're doing. I think we're taking that knowledge that we can use for things like malaria, and we're playing. And I think it's too dangerous to play.
I agree. And anything could happen. Something could go wrong.
Well, you know, people talk about the slippery slope, and other people say, no, 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 that's how we learn. We learn by experimenting and doing. And then, but now that we're at this level of manipulating atoms and genes, this is the basic building blocks of life. Now we're that, we're really down there where things come out of creation. We don't know that much. That's my personal feeling. We don't know that much to be playing there. We should learn, but we shouldn't play.
What's the downside to all of this?
Well, think about creating new organisms. What do we know about their reaction with existing organisms or with ourselves?
We don't. We don't, other than something could go wrong.
Even something as simple as, and it's not that simple as, you know, how we make plastics and then the phytoestrogens that show up in those plastics and then release and then we absorb them in our blood and then they affect our hormones. I mean, that's just something very on the macro level. But working down at the cellular level where you go in and manipulate the genome, cutting and pasting, we get new foods. We get foods that, you know, resist certain pests. Well, that's great. I have a huge garden, George. It's really hard to grow food because insects will come and undermine everything you do. I get the motive, but we have to be very careful when we rearrange and create things that don't exist yet. That's my feeling.
How do you teach somebody that, though?
We go in there together, and I have to be extremely careful not to tell them what I believe. This is what I believe. There are people who adamantly disagree with me about this, and some of my students will disagree, but what I do is I set it up so that they have conversations with one another and they explore, because what we have to do is not sort of fight about who's right. We have to explore together so that we come to some understanding through that exploration. That's how I teach.
And does anybody fight you on this?
No, you know, I bring them short stories, science fiction. It's all out there. There are all kinds of TV shows that look at these things. And so it's in the field, you know. It's in that field where humans are now asking, whoa, what are we doing? It's all over the movies. And so they don't fight me. They fight each other. I step back and let them do that.
What would you say, Rosalyn, might be the most unethical thing that you've come across that you try to highlight to people?
Well, none of the scientists I talk with had bad intentions or what I would say unethical intentions. They all wanted to learn. They all wanted to create.
They all start out okay, don't they?
Well, of course, and I think we're all well. Well, I don't want to say that. I think most of us are well-intended. We don't mean to do harm. It's when we don't think through or in ignorance that we act that worries me. The blatant doing of harm, that's pretty obvious stuff. And I tell my students, I don't need to tell you what's right and wrong. You know when you're hurting someone. It's when we're in the quandary, when we don't know, that's where I get really interested. Where we don't know that we're doing harm. Do we continue to do what we're doing?
What about some scientists who could be in other areas, North Korea somewhere, China, where ethics plays no part? What happens there?
Well, let's put it this way. It's culturally specific, and ethics look differently. And so what's good might be deemed what's good for the state or for the people rather than for particular circumstances. There's lots of different ways to sort out what we consider to be good or harmful. There are times when lying might seem appropriate. When you cross boundaries of culture, then it gets really hard with science because microorganisms are not going to pay attention to what we believe. They're going to just proliferate under certain circumstances, and so you know, we might have started out looking at splitting atoms just because we wanted to know if we could do it, and then we applied it to war with the creation of the bomb, and we thought that was the right thing because it ended World War II, which was important. And now we're dealing, of course, with North Korea, and it's very different. Well, should we have never have created that technology? People say, no, we needed it, or otherwise we wouldn't have learned what we've learned now. Well, now we're dealing with a whole other series of very serious problems.
Is it wrong to put a pig's valve in a human to keep their heart pumping?
Well, that's what we're doing for now until we can grow our own valves. We've used animals for eons.
I mean, it keeps people alive. I have a friend of mine who's got a cow aorta keeping him alive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's see. At some level, it gets absurd. At some level, it gets absurd because then you say, well, should we eat broccoli? There's life force in that broccoli. It's trying to proliferate. It's trying to keep its seeds. It's trying to grow.
Broccoli, it's good for you, I guess.
Right. So we might. So how do you decide? Is it how much consciousness they have? Is it how much self-awareness that they have? Do we not use? We don't use other humans at this point. Although in some cultures they do.
Hold on, Rosalind. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk more about ethics and also this bond between animals and humans. And we'll take your calls next.